Daniel Pipes is with us. He's a historian and president of the Middle East Forum. Daniel, thanks for being here.
Thanks for the invitation.
So earlier this morning when I got up, I felt like in the midst of so much bad news that's going on in the world and what's happening in Missouri and everything, I could for the first time feel that maybe something good has happened in an otherwise catastrophic, calamitous situation, and that we're making some strides against Islamic State, that we seem to have retaken control of this dam. Should I feel a glimmer of hope?
Absolutely. This is a piece of good news among a wave of bad news in the Middle East and perhaps elsewhere too.
So clarify for us exactly what this good news is.
Well, the Rust Dam was built 30 years ago and it was built very badly. So it needs constant grouting, constant reinforcement of its foundation, which has been a problem for 30 years. If it's not properly maintained, it could collapse, leading to a cataclysmic wave reaching Mosul, a city of almost 2 million, and eventually, and then a couple of days later, a city of 8 million, with incredible damage to life and property. There'd be no water afterwards, there'd be no electricity, a huge, huge catastrophe of life and property. So in addition to that, 2 weeks ago, the Islamic State, usually called ISIS, because it's easier to use it, to remember. ISIS, which is an extraordinarily fanatic Sunni Muslim organization, took over, not just Mosul, the city, in June, but now 2 weeks ago, Mosul Dam, giving an extraordinary leverage over water, electricity, and the threat of flooding, holding water, and the like. It just gave it so much more power than it had before that. And now, yesterday, with the aid of American air power, the government of Iraq and the Kurdish, since the autonomous government in north of Iraq, worked together to take back the dam.
When you say that ISIS took over Mosul, what does that mean in a practical sense on the ground? What does it mean to take over a city for people who are living there? How does their life change?
It changed dramatically in that ISIS insists on absolute Quranic injunctions and in the most severe fashion. So, for example, for the Christian minority that's lived there for some 2,000 years, life came to an end. Also, just every Christian had to leave or convert to Islam. It's a mass brutality. Been many hundreds killed, if not more, beheadings, shootings, and the like. It meant that the ISIS rule would follow every Quranic regulation to the extreme in terms of the status of women, minorities, what you can wear, what you must do and not do. It's like the Taliban in Afghanistan a decade ago, but even more. This is the most extreme Islamic group to take power anywhere. So extreme, as many have noted, that even Al-Qaeda has created it.
And they've used water before as a tactic, have they, in terms of the significance of their having seized the dam?
Yes, they have. In February, they controlled for a short period a smaller dam called the Fallujah Barrage, and they did use it as such. They let water out so it flooded, and they threatened to do more, and then they lost it. They didn't do that in the much larger Mosul dam, but the prospect was there. So, yes, they had a history of doing this. They have a history of utter barbarism. And by the way, in 1938, in the course of the Chinese defense against Japan, the Chinese government opened a dam on the Yellow River, killing an estimated 500,000 Chinese. So they did it to their own population as part of their defense, and it didn't work. It was not just this huge loss of life, but also strategically futile.
Wait, I wasn't familiar with that tactic. China murdered 500,000 of its own people in a strategy against Japan. What was the thinking? Why would that hurt Japan?
Well, they thought that by flooding the area, it would stop the Japanese.
Wow. So, if ISIS had kept this dam, I'd read that maybe 1.7 million people relied on it. Is that right? For water, for electricity, they'd basically have control over whether people can drink. They'd have control over whether people have power. And worst case scenario, if they decided to do something nuts like blow up the dam, they could flood basically the capital city of Kurdistan and kill uncountable numbers of people.
Many more than 1.7 million. That's the number who live in Mosul, which is just 2 hours away. If the water were to flood, it would take 2 hours to get to Mosul. So Mosul would be done. And they estimate something like a 60-foot wave would come. There would be nothing left. It would be like a tsunami. But the electricity, the whole country depends on. And Baghdad is downriver from it. And Samarra, it would just be a cataclysmic event. So for the moment, that seems not likely to happen. Though, remember, the grid used to place all the time. And if it doesn't, experts estimate it would take a few months before the dam would collapse. And part of the fear was ISIS didn't have the skills, or the people necessary to carry out this crowding wouldn't be there. It would disappear. So at least that's not the current worry, but it is there all the time. You can't ever stop heading to this dam.
How did we get them? How did we push them back? To what extent was it dependent on American firepower? To what extent was it the Iraqis and the Kurds on the ground?
I can't tell you exactly from the accounts that I've read. But clearly American air power both was helpful in itself in that it destroyed a number of ISIS cars. And they don't really have tanks, but armored personnel carriers. Also, it also invigorated the other forces. And particularly important was the other forces joined together. The Kurds in the center of Manila, Iraq, are not generally in good terms. But given this crisis, they came together. And it looks like they're sticking together, and the American power is still there. So there's now, as we speak, an attack on Tikrit, which is another town under ISIS control. And should that go well, one can expect forthcoming an attack on Mosul itself, which would be a huge loss for ISIS. I mean, ISIS came on the map, established itself in power with the seizure of Mosul, Steve Ostermann, a month ago. So I would expect that will be in the cards.
And when you talk about the Iraqi forces and the Kurds who are working together to oppose ISIS, it reminds me a little bit of the awakening, of course, where Iraqis came together and sort of prevented the descent into civil war that was going on in 06 through to 08. Is there any chance that this is anything more than just an expedient coalition to try to rout ISIS, and that this could be the beginning or the foundations of a more lasting collaboration between the different Iraqi factions? Or do you think this is just a one-time thing, and that once ISIS is triumphed, they'll start fighting each other again?
I'd be inclined to the latter, is a one-time thing, because the Kurds want separation. They're already autonomous and talking about independence. The central government of Iraq, of course, is against it, wants to control the whole of Iraq. So their long-term goals are very different. But in a time of crisis, with ISIS rearing its head, brutal, starving, killing people, threatening everyone, it made sense for them to come together. And also, it brought the United States and Britain into the conflict, which was not expected. You know, Barack Obama's rise in 2007 was essentially based on his opposition to the Iraq war. So this is not in his DNA. This is not something he forced them doing. And I think what tipped him, and also David Cameron, the British Prime Minister, was the prospect of tens of thousands of Yazidis, a minority religion, starving to death. It's just something couldn't accept.
Yeah, and then, sorry, go ahead.
And then interestingly, the justification that the president gave yesterday for this campaign was that were the Mosul Dam to be breached, it would reach Baghdad and it would threaten the U.S. Embassy. Rather kind of technical small detail in this cataclysm, but nonetheless, one he picked on to say, look, we're there to protect Americans in Erbil, which is the capital of Kurdish region, and in Baghdad, the capital of Iraq, that we're here for limited purposes to protect Americans. We're not here to fix Iraq. We're not the Iraqi army or air force.
I do feel like one of the bad legacies, one of the worst legacies of the Iraq war was the question mark that it's raised over any attempt to do a humanitarian intervention, because the fact that the war ended up being justifications ended up migrating from the bogus WMD claims into a kind of a humanitarian, we have to save people from Saddam rhetoric, means that now, even when there is a clear case where we can have a positive humanitarian impact, like saving tens of thousands of starving people who are surrounded by the most horrible terrorists in the world, we still have an instinctive, reflexive reluctance to do so, and we have to invoke the fact that there's an embassy in Baghdad and that there are Americans in Erbil and that that's the reason why we're going in. It would be nice if it were possible for us to say, yes, we've done some bad things with American power, but we still have the capability to do a lot of good things as well, and here's an obvious, limited, tactical thing that we can do for humanitarian reasons alone.
Well, I basically agree with you, but I make 2 points. First, I think the real shift was not so much from the nuclear weapons in 2003-4 to creating a free and prosperous Iraq, that, you know, we had grand goals. And that was what President Bush aspired to do and failed. And secondly, yes, this is unfortunate to have to make these excuses, but that's what politicians do. This is not something unique. And we all kind of know why he's saying it, why he feels he must say it.
Sure.
And finally, I note that there hasn't been much opposition, in particular on the left, which was so upset in a decade ago by what U.S. and allied forces were doing in Iraq. It's been fairly muted. If it goes on and on, I think the opposition will increase. But at this point, after only a few days, it's there's not much.
True. Of course, the long-term fate of Iraq is totally contingent on what the political situation in Baghdad ends up panning out as being. This is now a time of huge political change in Baghdad, with Maliki on his way out. President Obama made a statement yesterday and urged the new Iraqi leader to form an inclusive government. Let's just take a quick listen to that.
We will continue to pursue a long-term strategy to turn the tide against ISIL by supporting the new Iraqi government and working with key partners in the region and beyond. Over the last week, we saw historic progress as Iraqis named a new prime minister designate, Haider al-Abadi, and Iraq's outgoing Prime Minister Maliki agreed to step down. This peaceful transition of power will mark a major milestone in Iraq's political development, but as I think we're all aware, the work is not yet done. Over the next few weeks, Dr. Abadi needs to complete the work of forming a new, broad-based, inclusive Iraqi government, one that develops a national program to address the interests of all Iraqis. Without that progress, extremists like ISIL can continue to prey upon Iraq's divisions.
Daniel Pipes is with us of the Middle East Forum. You can feel free to give us a call if you have any questions about Iraq, 866-994-6343, 866-99-INDY. Daniel, tell us about Abadi, this new leader, and what does it mean? Maliki, of course, has been in power since the very beginning, right? Has there been any other prime minister since the...
Yes, there were before him. He came to power in 2006.
That's right, 2006. Yes.
With American support. And he turned out to be essentially an agent of Iran. That is to say, focusing on the power, increasing the power of the Shiites, who are majority in Iraq, at the expense of the Sunnis and the Kurds. The latter, which rebelled against this. I am more skeptical than the president about the prospects for an Iraq. I think Iraq, as such, like Syria, its neighbor to the west, pretty much gone. It's never going to be reconstituted. And both of them have largely, basically, three divisions. The Shiites, who run the country with Iranian support. The Sunnis, who are rebelling and creating their own territories and rule. And the Kurds already have their own territories and rule. And these three-way divisions are likely to last for a very long time. I don't see an Iraq, an integral, united Iraq re-emerging from this.
Was Joe Biden right a decade ago then when he was proposing that we should just split the whole thing up and federate it?
Yeah, that was something that people from time to time talked about. It was very radical and seemed, you know, fringe-like. I myself never gave it a thought. But yeah, I think it is right. I think it's better for the Iraqis and better for the rest of us to have three Iraqs rather than three Syrians rather than one. These are both failed states. Hafez al-Assad ruled for 30 years in Syria, Saddam Hussein for about as long in Iraq. And they were, you know, just the most monstrous rulers. And their legacies have not been overcome. these two countries remain in the throes of the most awful civil wars and violence. So yeah, let's crack them. Let's not crack them. Let's watch as they crack open and form three different polities. In particular, I think the Kurds have done a good job in northern Iraq and are doing a pretty good job as they start their own autonomous region in Syria, so let's not get in the way of that.
Yeah, I mean, the Kurds are going to find a way to do it, and as you say, they are finding a way to do it, and also because they're a known quantity to us and to the rest of the West, right? I mean, we have partners there who we understand. We have long-standing relationships with the Kurds. The question is, if you were going to split off Iraq into two other bits and give a portion to the Sunnis and a portion to the Shia, I can't believe we're still talking about this. It feels like this is 2003. But if you were going to do this, then is there a way of doing that without it being acrimonious? And is there a way of doing it without having either one of those become a radicalized, hate-filled entity that is permanently kind of on a war footing towards the other?
Well, if we in the West have the will to go in and move things around, then yes, but we're not about to do that for the reasons you alluded to earlier. The Western experience in Iraq was a very bitter one and essentially a failed one. So who is going to lead the charge now? Certainly not the U.S. president, and I doubt anybody else. So,
and even if we could, would we have any remaining credibility? I mean, I just can't imagine that we'd be able to do anything with any greater nuance than we were able to in the first 10 years that we were there. But maybe we've learned our lessons, I don't know.
Creating countries and dividing countries is not something easily done. And no, the U.S. does not have a good record in this, and I think it would be very difficult, too. So let's just accept that this is not something that we on the outside are going to steer. It's going to take place on its own. And I'm predicting that this is in the cards, and there will be a lot of acrimony, and there will be a lot of violence. But I think overall, this is a good thing. To put it differently, it was almost exactly 100 years ago in 1916 that British and French diplomats got together and in the midst of World War I created a new order for the Middle East to replace the Ottoman order. It's called the Sykes-Picot Agreement. It's been in effect in essentially for 98 years now, and it's dominated, and it didn't work out. And what we're seeing now is, finally, a century later, the destruction of this early 20th century agreement between the British and French governments on how to create Syria and Iraq and the like is falling apart, and good riddance to it. It was a great failure.
The Economist recently editorialized about this and said, listen, the borders were drawn up in stupid ways by the English and the French during and after World War I. The collapse of the Ottoman Empire was not handled well by the Western colonial powers. Yes, all of these borders are arbitrary. Yes, there's no reason why Iraq should be Iraq and Syria, Syria, in precisely the ways that they are constituted. But you know what? There are lots of countries that have lots of random reasons for existing. There's no necessary rhyme or reason why the U.S.-Canada border is exactly where it is. It could be in different places. And the best thing for liberal-minded, progressive, democracy-loving people to do is to stick with whatever borders you've got, find a way to figure it out, find a way to create power-sharing structures that foster collaboration rather than enmity, and deal with it. So they come down on the side of keep Iraq as it is and keep Syria as it is. That's the most cautious and conservative option. What's your response to that?
To which these are failed states. I conjured up the names of Hafez al-Assad and Saddam Hussein before. They've been gone now for a decade and more, but nothing has gone right in either of these countries. Everything is wrong, from the grouting at the Mosul Dam to the disappearance of water.
But I mean, sorry to interrupt, but to what extent can we blame that on the way that the borders are drawn, and to what extent can we blame it on the fact that they've had tyrants who we've occasionally supported, and we've constantly been meddling in their affairs for basically the past half century, right? I mean, you've got to factor in the fact that Saddam Hussein and Bashar al-Assad exist when figuring out why these states have failed.
One of the most important reasons why these monstrous dictators have ruled for so long and why they're now major civil wars is that these countries are made up of three ethnic groups that are not willing to live together. And the only way they can live together is by one dominating the others. So, for example, in Syria, the Alawis, who make up about an eighth of the population, took control in 1966, almost half a century ago, and have been taking advantage of this control for 48 years at the expense of everyone else. Now everyone else has had a chance to say what they think of this, and they're rebelling. And I say more power to them. Let this thing collapse. It was bad enough before the fighting began 3 years ago. It'll be even worse in the future if there's a single Syria. And likewise for Iraq. These people cannot live together. Let them live apart. Why? Because a French and British diplomat reached an agreement in 1916. Are they doomed in perpetuity to live together, fight together, and live under monstrous dictators together? Why?
What do we need to know about the new Iraqi leader, about Abadi? Who is he, and do you have faith that he can midwife this process?
Well, he has been in the background of Maliki's rule. I don't know an awful lot about him. The things I've learned recently suggest that he is of more moderate character, less trying to push the Shiites forward at the expense of the Arab Sunnis and the Kurdish Sunnis. And remarkably, the Iranian and American governments both have endorsed him. This is not something that happens every day. I think the Iranians realize that although Maliki was their man, he was inept, and they're better off with someone else in Baghdad.
Do our interests align with the Iranians in Iraq?
Sorry, again?
Do our interests align with the Iranians in Iraq?
No, they don't, except at this one conjunction. No. The Iranians see Iraq as a natural extension of Iran. Remember, they fought for 8 long years in the 1980s with Saddam Hussein. They have bitter memories, especially of the leadership, and they want to control Iraq. And Maliki was their agent to do that, but he was inept. Now, Abadi is likely to be their agent. They come from the same political party, which is essentially a pro-Iranian Islamist party. And if Abadi has a lighter touch and is more able to bring the various factions together, then he'll be more successful. But ultimately, no. The Iranians seek an Iraq under their control, and we obviously don't want that.
Okay, we'll keep an eye on it. And thank you so much, Daniel, for filling us in. It's great to talk to you.
Sure. Great to talk to you.